never suppose I get you down, and the missionism's looking blue. Get into the kitchen, get out your pan, and cook a little dish of blue.
Whenever the decline of the capitalist system seems to be coming through,
get into your kitchen, get out your pants, and cook a little dish of blue. Here's our recipe.
Okay, so I am here with Allegra Goodman, who is most recently the author of The Cookbook Collector. Allegra, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
Okay, I wanted to actually talk to you about something that I find to be really interesting, particularly in your later books. In Intuition, you had the characters approaching science from an almost intense secular religious belief. And in this book, The Cookbook Collector, what's interesting to me is that the characters are approaching the triple pillars of environmentalism, the dot-com renaissance, and of course Judaism, with a similar kind of religiosity. And I'm wondering why your characters tend to really approach life in general with this sense of religiosity. Is this the best way to really commit their passions and their essence to the page?
Well, you know, that's interesting to put it that way. First of all, I'm interested in characters who are passionate, who believe in something.
Yeah.
I think it's more fun to write about people who believe in something than about people who believe in nothing or believe in very trivial things. And second of all, I think that in novels, I'm interested in really a very big question, which is how should we live? How do we live? And this book, which centers on two young sisters in their 20s, this is a time when they're trying to figure out how they should live, who they should be with, very fundamental questions, you know. Do you look for rules about how to live as you would in a cookbook for finding a recipe, or do you make up your own recipe?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I mentioned the religiosity because there's a moment where you actually write, Emily held her cup of coffee in two hands and watched Veritech flying high. There's the moment where she takes the champagne flute glass. So there are certain rites, particularly centered around objects, that sort of tie into their often blind passion. And I'm curious if you approach the creation of a character or the expression of a character from this kind of intense spirit first and foremost, or do you allow it in the course of writing to just define it on the page?
I think I start with the character, and then the character herself or himself, the passions emerge. I think it's a good point that you make about Emily's intense, almost spiritual reaction to what's happening to her company, which is going public, and to the economy, which is exploding around her. And I was really interested in the way that seemingly worldly people who are involved in, you know, dot-com companies, they can be very idealistic, and they can be the biggest dreamers.
Yeah.
On the other side of the equation, if you want to sort of touch on the Jewish stuff, the rabbis in this book, who are mystics by profession, are actually very worldly rabbis.
Yeah.
They're really interested in the economy. They're interested in day trading. One of them, particular Rabbi Helfgott. So that sort of combination of world, or the ways that spirituality and worldliness cross and define each other, is very important to me.
Actually, the rabbis reminded me very much. Have you seen Aronofsky's movie Pi?
Yeah.
With the connection between the economy and the rabbis in that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing about the rabbis, too, is that they tend to just show up in convenient moments, and I kind of liked that idea. I'm wondering, I mean, they're not quite rabbis ex machina, but they are rather conveniently there to sort of introduce themselves to characters. I'm wondering how that came about.
Well, they do pop up. You know, when I set Jess in Berkeley. She lives in Berkeley, and Berkeley's full of different sorts of characters. You know, there are environmentalists there. There are health food people there, very political people there. And this rabbi is sort of one of the cast of characters in Berkeley, and somebody that she begins a conversation with. One of the interesting things about these rabbis in their mysticism, they don't believe in coincidence.
Yeah.
So they really believe in this sort of design.
Yeah.
And again, I was interested in the parallels between that kind of belief in design and that faith in providence and what was happening in the economy at that time, when everybody thought things were going to go on forever. And there was sort of an economic messianism, if you will, in the late 90s. So all of that interested me very much.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is that your description is very sparse, because we never really get a sense of the locations where these people meet, which I found a very interesting choice. I mean, you don't really describe much. Like, there's a part where you describe Harvard Square, and you're really only describing the objects that are there for consumption, or the roles of ivy and vine that come and infiltrate a particular setting. Was this your way of mimicking the insular nature of your characters? Was this lack of description by design? Or?
Well, you know, I think whenever you are doing description, you have to make choices about what you describe. Mm-hmm. And actually, the book is pretty heavily detailed. It's just that I had to pick and choose what details to use.
Yeah.
I did focus on the objects because I think that threading through this book is a story of the economy and materialism.
Yeah.
But George's house, for example, is very lavishly described. His bookstore, there's the Rose Garden. There are places that I describe in great detail.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of objects, when did the bookstore idea come about in George's Yorick's, which is, of course, Tristram Shandy, not Hamlet, which is a nice little touch. You know, the sense with him is that because this is, in a way, a pre-9/11 novel, there's a sense with George that he could really turn into some neoconservative, libertarian-minded blogger if he's not too careful. I'm wondering, what element of the book did you have first? The sort of the dot-com culture, the books, the Save the Trees activists? Or?
Well, the dot-com culture, from the beginning, I wanted to write a novel set during that time. I knew it was going to be a historical novel about the very recent past.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to write a novel about a historical novel about a time that we all remember or think we remember and that we've lived through, as opposed to writing a historical novel about, say, the French Revolution or something like that. Yeah. Who can say really for sure what was going on in the minds and hearts of those people in the French Revolution? It's parallel to that idea. I had the idea about the cookbooks. So I would say those were parallel. The Tree Savers came later in terms of the people that Jess got involved with. And George... I had this idea. I knew that he had made a fortune. I call him old money from the 1980s. I knew he'd made a fortune at Microsoft. And I wanted to incorporate a trove of rare cookbooks. So from there, I got the idea of George being a dealer.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you call it a historical novel. I wanted to actually ask you a little bit more about that. I mean, can one only really write about human events as a historical novel these days? Because technology, life changes so fast that it's hard to really keep up with what's happening in the present. I mean, in a sense, you're memorializing it, perhaps now more than any other time. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that's definitely true in terms of technology. It's not necessarily true in terms of all aspects of human life, but in terms of the technology, in which a generation can go by in 6 months or a year, you know, It really felt like ancient history. And the acceleration of the business cycles that was happening during that time, which is now slowed down again, is really, really fascinating. So I just found it a really rich subject.
Yeah. But also with the materials, like there's that line where there's the box of National Geographics from like 1910, 1970 or something along those lines. And then the character basically says, why would you want to hold on to those? You know, dedicate them to a library. They're going to be digitized anyway. I mean, the fact of the matter is that objects in this book, in a certain sense, are meant to be passed along to somebody else without any idea of what, where they're going to go or how they're going to be dealt with. It's a very funny little consumerist theme going on here.
Well, and different characters have different ideas about objects. You know, Emily definitely says, oh, please, you don't have room for all of those National Geographics. You can get them online, donate them, you know, immediately.
Yeah.
Somebody like George fetishizes objects and reveres them. He collects antique typewriters. He is nostalgic about old technology. And for him, these objects almost they're like talismans. They take on a sort of mystical importance. And Jess sort of has to decide where she falls along in this spectrum. Is she more like Emily? Is she more like her boyfriend, Leon, who reveres the natural world?
Yeah.
Or is she becoming seduced by George and his art and his antique maps and these beautiful books?
Yeah. But you also have Orion, who is the son of the sort of Gary Snyder-like beat poet who comes in near the end and delivers an inappropriate poem, even though it sort of represents a cyclical artistic culture. And Sorrel, who also is an artist in her own right, both of these two characters are almost committed to becoming coders. And it's almost as if the idea of any kind of culture preserving in the 90s or beyond is going to inevitably go pour into technology, that George really is one of the only holdouts. So the other option is to become a tree saver. I'm curious as to why there were so many artists who became so easily objectified themselves into this technological world.
Yeah, it's a complicated question. But really the central question is sort of what lasts. Is it those high-flying companies whose names we can't remember anymore,
yeah,
or who evolved or who were bought by other companies, and this sort of, you can see the little fish being eaten by the big fish in that,
yeah,
in that environment? Or is it the cookbooks that are left behind by a mysterious collector? And if so, what is it about those books that makes them important? Where do we find significance? Where do we find value? And those are the questions that I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the cookbook recipes or the cookbooks that are left behind, I'm curious how much of those recipes were invented on your part and the nature of research in this, because there's a point where Jess paraphrases Hume, but it's not anything near Hume. So it's almost as if the relationship to text, whether it be through a cookbook or John Muir or Hume or whatnot, is going to be corrupted even if you are a doctoral candidate. So,
well, not corrupted, but interpreted.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's a difference, you know, and interpretation, some people might say every interpretation is a corruption, and other people might say no.
Yeah.
Every interpretation is a reading, and that, you know, texts and historical artifacts are fluid and fungible. Jess, in terms of my own research and my use of these texts within my own text, the Hume that Jess paraphrases is really in Hume. It's not necessarily the Hume that you might focus on if you were a philosopher.
Yeah.
The cookbooks themselves are real, and I researched them at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard, and the recipes are real. Those are actual quotations from the recipes. What Jess makes of them and what she makes of the marginalia in the cookbooks is another story.
Well, the interesting thing, too, about that, the marginalia and the like, I mean, it calls into question just, I'm curious if when you did all this research and you had all this text to sample from or to put into your own book, whether concrete details along those lines were more of a hindrance or a help. Whether if you have too much information, almost as a novelist who is juggling numerous characters and numerous subplots, it may get in the way of the fluidity of the text. Maybe you can talk about this here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the danger as a novelist is to, especially somebody writing an ambitious multi-layered book, is that you get so entranced with one aspect that it can sort of start taking over.
Yeah.
So I think that the answer is that you have to find what's significant for your story and for your characters. And that's what I did. So you have to be fairly disciplined about pulling back.
Yeah. Would you say that you're a natural divagator? Because one thing that's interesting about your books is that we'll go from one character to another at any kind of flit. I mean, we'll be in the middle of George's head, and then we'll go into somebody else. And I'm curious, at what point in either drafting or revision does that come fixed? I mean, it's clear, as from your last answer, that you're very much a natural associator. But I'm wondering what you do to encourage the association so that it gets that hard fluidity. What steps do you take to do that?
Well, I think I pretty naturally move from one point of view to the other. And I negotiate between the points of view, and I have to, as in my revision process, make sure that some characters don't dominate or don't detract from the main story. There were things that I cut and trimmed back. The rabbis actually trimmed back a lot in the course of writing this book because they were detracting from the central story of the sisters. Now, you know, that was just a decision that I made in terms of the final shape of the story. In terms of working with multiple points of view, it's something that I've always really enjoyed. And when I was a really young writer, I admired Tolstoy's use of multiple points of view and his ability, sort of chameleon-like ability to inhabit different people, you know, young girl, an old man, somebody dying, a gambler, you know. Now, I don't try, in this book, I do limit myself. I don't take on, you know, I don't really describe Leon from the inside. Not all characters are privileged to see from the inside.
Yeah.
Molly, not so much from the inside, but
yeah,
a lot of them I do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is interesting, too, because Jonathan. I don't want to give away what happens to him, but he becomes, at one point in the book, such a wonderfully Machiavellian and dominant presence. And then when we learn of his fate, it's actually rather funny, because his fate occurs at a point where he threatens to really subsume the actual story. I'm wondering if you felt a certain Schadenfreude writing this character, because he just really becomes this scenery chewer at some point. It's very enjoyable, but in terms of balancing all the characters, was he possibly problematic because his presence became so large?
Interesting question. Well, he does have a huge presence, and I don't know. I always, to me, Emily, although she was quieter, had also a very strong presence.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that was part of the conflict between them and the tension between them. No, I didn't feel Schadenfreude, but I knew he had to go.
I mean, I mention this because his dialogue is so reflective of, like, Sergey Brin. I mean, he says things like, "Introduce me, I'm serious." Very Star Trekian, like, in his
actually,
dialogue.
Yeah, that's I mean, I'm glad you raised that, because in terms of research into the dot-commerce, I did not go to libraries, obviously, or do the kind of research. You can't research them the way you would a group of rare cookbooks, but my research consisted of listening to the way they talk.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm very interested in voices and the way somebody like Bill Gates talks, the way somebody like Sergey Brin talks. I'm interested in their sort of militant casualness.
Yeah.
They're very bright. They're very ambitious. They're very driven. They're very chummy and casual and, like, let's all just, you know, make this happen and, you know, in a way... anti-intellectual in some ways in their rhetoric, not that they are intellectual, a lot of them, and I don't mean to jump, you know, lump all of them together, but I listened to the rhetoric that they use.
Who did you listen to, specific tapes or recordings or YouTube?
I was interested in Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and some of the younger voices that I was reading in interviews in magazines at the time. The way researchers talk, the way techie people talk, the way programmers talk, not necessarily just the powerful ones, but just this is the words that they use.
Yeah.
And I was interested, actually, that, you know, Jess and George are very literary, and they their dialogue and their banter has a lot of references to books and things like that, and people have mentioned this about my book. But there's this counterweight which people don't mention. Maybe they don't hear it because it's so obvious. It's like what we hear all the time. It doesn't stick out. But it's very not literary. It's very anti-intellectual.
Yeah.
Techie.
Jonathan quibbles with tenuous at one point, looking at it like a mystified word. But this is interesting, because I'm wondering if one of the motivating factors to write this novel is because the 1990s, God, that time was incredible, the way that we documented everything about the dot-com era. We documented everything about our culture. We wanted to publicize our own vacuity, so to speak. I'm wondering if this made things easier from a novelistic standpoint.
Well, it's really interesting because we did document that era, and we still do.
Yeah.
And it's been so well documented. But what I always think is, so what can my contribution be as a novelist as opposed to being a historian or an economist or even a psychologist or a sociologist? People talked about the different syndromes of sudden wealth at the time. There was a tremendous amount of journalism at the time and after. The aftermath, the postmortems.
Yeah.
So what could I contribute as a novelist? And what I can contribute is to write about it from the inside rather than from the outside. To write about it, to give an intimate portrait rather than the broad overview. And as I did in Intuition, to talk about motivation, which journalists aren't really not allowed to talk about.
Yeah.
But novelists get to do.
Yeah, so. That's true. Well, Veritech is an actual company in Massachusetts, so I'm wondering if you
I found that out later. It's like trying to name a rock band. It's sort of all the good names are taken, like no matter how far flung they might be.
Okay.
It was unconscious.
So there was really no concern over whether there were parallels to something like Lockbox or whatnot as you were.
No. Yeah. Okay. I was trying to make something plausible, feasible, but not, you know.
Dwelling upon parallels to reality was kind of a hindrance or an obstacle.
Well, I'm like a journalist again. Journalists try to sort of work toward the truth or some approximation of it. I work away from the truth.
Yes. I wanted to talk about Mel and the ageist component. that is very rarely talked about that particular age, you know. And yet you're very clear about his character. I mean, he says, you know, he had never inhaled the fumes of such success, and although every fiber of his body rebelled against the insane pressure of his job, his soul rejoiced. The interesting thing about Mel is that he's almost this literary median between the literary world and the dot-com world. Was he intended more along those lines, or did you want to focus on the ageism aspect of the dot-com world that really was still not really talked about that much?
Yeah, I was really interested in that, the generational tension there.
Yeah.
And Mel is sort of the only guy over 50 at his company. And, you know, in a company where it's rare to be over 30, actually.
Yeah.
They're all kind of in their 20s and ex-graduate students. And Jonathan steals Mel away from MIT to help them out. And he's feeling a bit of whiplash. I was interested in the ageism, which, again, I thought was interesting because people don't talk about it. And
yeah.
Somebody from the old economy who's feeling a little bit startled. And just like George is sort of more of a throwback to an older world, so is Mel. And he's in a way, a victim and, in a way, a pawn.
Yeah. Well, what other aspects do you think weren't really dwelled upon from the journalistic documents?
Well, I mean, this has been documented, but... in different way. I'm really interested in sort of the way people get warped by money.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, economists can talk about that. Psychologists can talk about that. But I could sort of present it from the inside, where the reader was actually privy to the thoughts and dreams and hopes and fears of certain individuals. And, you know, decisions that seem smaller in regular life and fidelities that seem easier become more problematic when there are huge, huge amounts of money at stake.
Yeah.
And that really interested me.
Molly's father is named Carl Eisenstadt, maintaining the Eisenstadt principle of viscosity. Now, is this a reference to Austin Neocross? He also had a theory of viscosity, and it was used to for a kind of business thing. I mean, it almost seemed to me that this was an homage to kind of the self-made men of 50 years ago or whatnot. Did you discover the theory of viscosity on your own? Is that why you took the phrase?
I discovered it on my own.
Yeah.
I like your thinking. But that's another case, like the company that's really named Veritech. But
yeah.
You're right about it's the older generation of science.
Yeah.
Just like Mel is the older generation of business and George is sort of the older generation of art and literature. Carl, Molly's father, is from this era of physics and pure science.
Yeah.
And he's now, you know, suddenly experiencing this explosion of the information age and a new kind of science.
Yeah.
And a new kind of industry.
Yeah.
And first he's distrustful of it. But again, when he sees the money and the profits that could be made, he's actually kind of enthralled with it.
But it is interesting how this is a book about the information age that doesn't feel particularly informational. Were you concerned with that possibility of the text reflecting the particular time, or were you just more... I mean, you've boldly set out to describe this as a sense and sensibility for the dot-com era. Quite a bold claim to compare yourself to Austin, but I could actually totally buy it after having read the book. And the question is in order to understand a time like the dot-com era, is it best to write a book that feels from a different century?
Well, you know, one of the things that really interests me is that I think that everything new is old again. And to me, it was very appropriate to use a 19th century form. It's a very old-fashioned novel in some ways.
Yeah.
A novel of character, a novel of plots and subplots that weave themselves together, a novel of revelations. I think that, you know, the technology is new, but the kinds of motivations that people had and the social relations that they have are actually not new. And to me, harken back to the industrial age.
Yeah.
Very conscious on my part to take the form and use it for this subject.
So really, any novelist who is thrashing about saying that the novel is dead or some David Shields-like figure or whatnot really is missing the point that essentially the novel constantly, I guess, churns out the same bits over and over again, just in different sequences and different forms and different feels, or nothing really is new at the end of the day? Or?
Well, you know, I think that the novel evolves. I think to say that the novel is dead is actually not that interesting to me.
Yeah.
But the novel evolves and it persists in the way that representational painting persists.
Yeah.
And of course, there are non-representational novels, you know, and other kinds of painting that are very powerful and wonderful. But I find it a very useful form for talking about human relationships, which are endlessly fascinating.
Human behavior, human relationships are really the ultimate form of what the novel should
motivation.
Chronicle. Yeah.
And motivation. I mean, what can a novel do that a film can't do, for example?
Yeah.
Well, the important thing is that it can tell you what people are thinking.
Yeah.
As opposed to what people are saying or doing or how they look.
And smell, I would say, too.
Yeah.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
All the senses.
Well, on that sensory overload, very applicable to the book. Allegra, thanks very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right.